Hello and welcome to another episode of TWIML Talk, the podcast where I interview interesting people doing interesting things in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I'm your host, Sam Charrington. Once again, the recording you're about to hear is part of a series of interviews I recorded live from the O'Reilly AI and Strata conferences in New York City. My guest this time is Pascal Fung, professor of electrical and computer engineering at Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. Pascal gave a really interesting presentation at the AI conference focused on how we teach computers and robots to understand human emotion and be empathetic. She also had some really interesting things to say about the theoretical foundations of the various modern approaches to speech understanding, and we dig into all of this in our conversation. As always, I'll be linking to Pascal and her research in the show notes, which you'll be able to find at twimlai.com/talk/9. As is unfortunately the case with my other field recordings, there's a bit of unavoidable background noise, but it's not too bad. And now, on to the show. All right. Hey, everyone. I'm here at the O'Reilly AI conference, and I'm with Pascal Fung, who is a professor of electrical engineering at Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. And I sat in on her talk earlier on emotions and AI and how do we enable computers to recognize emotions. And she graciously agreed to spend a few minutes with us to tell us a little bit about what she's working on. Mm-hmm. So welcome, Pascal.
Thank you.
How about we start with talking a little bit about your background and the kinds of things you work on?
Sure. So my background, I am an electrical engineer and computer scientist, and I've been working on speech recognition since 1988 and then move on to statistical machine translation in the 90s. And after I became a professor at HKUST, I lead a team working on speech language and more recently on emotion and mood recognition, or sort of using statistical modeling and machine learning methods. That's my technical background. I worked at different places before. I was a student while working on my PhD thesis at Bell Labs. I was very lucky to work with some of the best people in the area. And in the early 90s, when I started my thesis, it was when the field of natural language processing was transforming from a heavily knowledge-based, linguistics-based field to statistical modeling. And at the time, statistical modeling for language was very controversial. Right. People actually didn't believe you could learn language or study language or understand language with just statistics. But, 20 years later, now that is the mainstream approach. Almost everything we do is with machine learning and statistical modeling in natural language processing.
One of the slides you put up had a quote from a professor who I think you mentioned you work with that said, "For every linguist I fire, I increase
Fred Jelinek, he's sort of the father of statistical speech recognition. So we owe the field owes a lot to him. He passed away a few years ago, and then this quote of his was, it was controversial, but
what was the quote?
The quote was that every time I fire a linguist, the speech recognition accuracy goes up. So it came from at the time at IBM, he was leading the IBM group with a group of mathematicians and information theoreticians to work on the problems of speech recognition, which was previously worked on using knowledge-based approach in AI. And actually, his group wasn't allowed to use that approach. They did it anyways. So there was always a little bit of conflict between the knowledge-based AI community and the, at the time, the statistical-minded people. So there were papers written about the empiricists versus rationalists. In the 90s, and I remember my first conference presentation on a statistical-based natural language processing paper. I was yelled at by some of the senior people in the field.
Wow.
Yeah, those were the days. But now it's totally non-controversial at all because you can see, you know, machine learning is everywhere.
Right.
And yeah.
Right.
So he said that because the approach he proposed, his group proposed, was very radical at the time, which is not looking at how to imitate human at all, mm-hmm. but just looking at the input and output were of the task. So, for example, for speech recognition, the input is speech waveforms, mm-hmm. and the output should be words, right? Mm-hmm. And for machine translation, the input could be French and output should be English.
Right.
And they basically treated all these problems as a kind of information theoretic problems to solve.
Mm-hmm.
So a different mathematical approach from the traditional knowledge-based AI approach at the time.
Can you maybe give a 30,000-foot background of information theory and how it plays into all this?
Okay, I'll try. So information theory was invented by the entire field. Came from a paper written by Claude Shannon in 1948 called The Mathematical Theory of Communication. So it basically looks at, you know, the information encoding. For example, if you want to transmit telephone signal mm-hmm. right, through telephone cable, there's only that much information you can transmit. And how many simultaneous calls can you transmit in one cable? It's limited by physics, actually.
Right.
And so the information theory really is talking about, you know, how do you encode, transmit, and decode information.
Mm-hmm.
So the earliest application was, of course, telephone. Systems.
Right.
So it was no accident that Claude Shannon was also at Bell Labs.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, information theory was then applied. Actually, at the time when Claude Shannon came up with this information theory, he already had a paper on the information of language.
Oh, really?
Yes. He actually wrote a paper very early about how language can be encoded and learned.
Okay.
And he was one of the earlier pioneers of AI, even though people don't think of him always that way.
Yes. I had no idea.
Yes, and he actually also had a Scientific American paper on the first chess playing algorithm.
Okay.
In the 60s. So, yeah, so information theory became an entire field of research. And it's applied widely in many, many different areas, most importantly in telecommunications and communications.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, in all the statistical learning field, we also use information theory. For example, we look at how how we can learn to model a language.
Uh-huh.
From an information theoretic point of view. So it's more like you can think of it as message encoding kind of way,
right.
Yeah, rather than linguistically motivated
right.
way. So it's a different way of looking at mathematical approach of looking at problems.
Right. You mentioned that in your talk, and I found that fascinating. It, mm-hmm. it never occurred to me. I think you posed the idea of thinking of the machine translation problem
mm-hmm.
as
mm-hmm.
you've got this message uh-huh. that is, you're trying to translate French to English. You've
yeah,
got this
yeah.
message that's in noisy English.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So how do you clean up the
yeah,
noise and
yeah,
get to
exactly.
the true English?
So for example, is exactly that. So for example, the word orders are different in
right.
different languages. So it can be, you can think of that word reordering as a kind of a distortion.
Right.
And then some of the words, actually in French and English, some of the words are the same.
Like 40% overlap, right?
Yeah. But other words are different. So you
right.
can, again, think of a word that's different in a different language being a kind of noise. I mean, a kind of distortion, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can learn that distortion, then you learn the translation. So, and that is some information theoretic approach. That's what Google Translate is still based on.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Interesting. So how, starting from, what are some of the the algorithms or approaches that kind of come out of the information theory background? Like, how is it applied more concretely to that problem?
Okay, so for example, all modern speech recognition software mm-hmm. is based on the noisy channel model.
Okay.
So the whole idea of you can train a speech recognizer with lots of data. So let's say voice search and all that. It's all based on what other people have said. Mm-hmm. And it's based on, these days, millions of hours of speech data, mm-hmm. like Siri, for example.
Yep.
It's trained on this data. And then it uses a different kind of machine learning method.
Mm-hmm.
And but all these speech recognition methodologies based on one big paradigm is still the noisy channel model, which is speech in, words out,
yeah,
right, through this channel. Now, the latest approaches has turned part of these methods into using deep learning
mm-hmm.
to replace some modules. For example, replacing how phonemes can be modeled, or replacing part of the predicting what word will come after which word.
Mm-hmm.
So some of this is now enabled by deep learning, but the whole paradigm is still a information theory approach. Similarly, for things like Google Translate, it's still based on the what I just talked about, the noisy channel model.
Okay.
And recently, there's some research work on using neural net, but we haven't seen any commercial application that claims to be using neural net for end-to-end neural net for machine translation yet.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So how did you get in?
Not to mention all the encryption software, all that is based on information theory.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that is not my field, but that's actually a main application for this kind of work. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome. Mm-hmm. How did you get into the study of emotion?
How did I get into the study of emotion? Basically, we noticed that I've been working on spoken language understanding for a long time.
Yeah.
And I've participated on different efforts from different generations of virtual agents, what we call virtual assistants today.
Okay.
So the earliest system in the 80s was funded by DARPA, which was a ticket booking system where you call and say, I want to go from here to there, and then it's trying to book a ticket for you.
Okay.
And from that time on, we have seen different generations of dialogue systems. Up until today, we have Siri and Cortana.
Right.
And working on these dialogue systems, I've noticed that we've always sort of just look at literal meaning of a user query.
Mm-hmm.
So the machine just pays attention to, you know, what is the destination, the origin city, how many tickets do you want, you know, what kind of restaurant you're looking for. So very literal interpretation of your query, which means that your query has to be very clear. These days, people always complain, oh, Siri doesn't work well and all that. To us researchers, we can see why it doesn't work well, because the system assumes users to be very clear and say explicitly what they really want to get.
Right.
And, you know, unless the users are lawyers, I mean, very few people talk that way. You know, we talk naturally. We expect you to understand what I mean.
Right.
And, for example, you just laughed because you know I was trying to be funny. And that kind of information is completely lost in our dialogue systems of previous generations. But it is very, very important for true communication. If we want to go past the current sort of a plateau of understanding, we have to also incorporate the understanding of emotion, intent, and all that.
Right.
In addition to understanding the meaning of the words. So that's when I started working on incorporating. So I don't work on recognizing emotion for emotion's sake. It's really recognizing emotion for communications. So it's what I, that's what I call empathy module.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I look at the future applications of what we do, some of the most immediate applications, that immediate in the sense that in the next 20 to 30 years, mm-hmm. we'll see widespread application, will be healthcare and elderly mm-hmm. care. Because by the year 2050, mm-hmm. there will be more old people than young children in the world. So, mm-hmm. and so elderly care is a big area, and governments will be running out of resources, human resources, to take care of these mm-hmm. elderly. So we're going to need a lot of machine assistance. Now, my mother lives, spends a lot of time alone. She's very independent. She's in her 70s. She doesn't want to live with me. And she wants to be left alone to do her own thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm always worried. And in her independence, you know, I worry about her health. She seems healthy when I see her. But at her age, I want to make sure that she's fine. Right now, for example, I want to know she's fine, right?
Right.
So this kind of, I want to know her health conditions, but also her mental conditions.
Mm-hmm.
So if she doesn't want to live with me, now how about if I have, if we build a home robot who can be there at her, you know, at her home or mm-hmm. be around her and converse with her. Mm-hmm. Sometimes just to get a sense of how she's doing, mm-hmm. simple things, mm-hmm. right? And then sends me a message so I know how she's, I mean, or sends me a curve of her vital signs in addition to her mm-hmm. emotional state, then that will help the guilty children, busy guilty children, but also help the elderly. Because, you know, a lot of people have emergency problems, like mm-hmm. a heart attack or something,
right.
that could have been, they could have been saved if someone knew. And then there are others who can get lonely and depressed, and mm-hmm. And then they can also be helped by machine to some extent, mm-hmm. not completely by machines. You know, living with just machines is also very sad, but...
Right.
But when there are not enough humans around, people mm-hmm. around, then the machines can help.
Mm-hmm.
So this is why I want to work on empathetic robots.
Hmm.
In the case, care of people.
In the case of a crisis situation like a heart attack, where does empathy and where does that come in?
I think heart attack, it's basically it's an emergency. Then the robot has to... basically alert, call the ambulance, right? That's the mm-hmm. first thing. But what empathy comes into play is that, so daily reminder to take medicine.
Right.
In some of the aging studies, mm-hmm. people have found that a lot of elderly, they don't want to take medicine unless somebody talks to them.
Okay.
Like, sometimes you have to... sort of entice them into, I mean, some elderly are like children.
Mm-hmm.
So in that case, though, the machine doesn't just say, take your medicine, and repeatedly insisting that you take your medicine, mm-hmm. like with the same command, that would be extremely annoying, mm-hmm. and it will have the opposite effect, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the machine needs to know that the elderly is hesitant or resisting,
mm-hmm.
and how is the person's patient's... emotional state, and to know whether now the machine can insist, or it's time to call a doctor or a nurse, mm-hmm. or whether, you know, telling the patient a bedtime story will soothe them.
Mm-hmm.
So that requires empathy. If you think about all the nurses, you know, in the hospital, a lot of their job, a lot of their work and their tasks are very repetitive.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the better nurses are the ones who really have a very good bedside manner.
Right.
And what is a bedside manner other than being empathetic?
Mm-hmm.
Just being empathetic, you know, for both doctors and nurses. So mm-hmm. if you want doctors and nurses to be empathetic, obviously you want the healthcare robots to be empathetic.
Right, right. Mm. Your talk, I interpreted its focus on empathy recognition, but your description is also talking about what you might call generative empathy.
Right, right. So empathy has two sides. It's the mm-hmm. emotion recognition,
right,
and then the appropriate emotional response.
Okay.
So empathy, I focus mostly on the emotion recognition part,
okay.
because that is hard. Until we can recognize emotion, we don't know how to react, right?
Right.
So I focus on that, and But the response part, I talked a little bit at the end that we're trying to learn the appropriate response mm-hmm. as well from data. So mm-hmm. also using deep learning.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned healthcare as a use case. Uh-huh. I think there's often, for a while now, people have talked about a customer service use case.
Right, sure.
You know, the hold line sure. will recognize when you're getting frustrated.
Sure. In fact, at AT&T Bell Labs in the 90s already, came up with a system called How May I Help You? Mm-hmm. So when you call the AT&T line, mm-hmm. It's a virtual assistant, virtual operator that talks to you first and says, how mm-hmm. may I help you? And you basically say whatever you want. And then it goes to different categories.
Yeah.
And that is an intention classifier.
Okay.
And also at the time, AT&T had internal programs to analyze all this call center data
right.
to see whether people are upset, they're happy yeah. and all that. So that is already the beginning of emotion recognition. That was my first contact with emotion recognition. And it was for customer service, indeed. It is a big area.
But I don't get the sense that it's widely deployed, or at least not in a way that I would see as an everyday
yeah,
person.
But it's,
maybe it's more analytical.
Yeah, it's at the back end. So this is the thing, because it's not consumer facing. It's really in the area, the realm of data analytics.
Yeah.
So it's more of a tool used by corporations to improve the efficiency of their call centers.
And a performance management.
Performance,
for
CSRs, yeah, they do
that
do
kind of
that.
Thing.
There are companies that provide technology to customer service for
okay.
this. Yeah.
Yeah, because my place in line never seems to accelerate because I'm
yeah.
angry.
yeah. Right.
So you also talked about the use of convolutional neural nets uh-huh. in recognizing emotion mm-hmm. and kind of drew some interesting correlations across, basically that the CNNs were able to functionally approximate the cochlear functionality.
Yeah, the human sound perception system, indeed.
Can you
That's
talk
what
a
we
bit
found.
About that?
So I think in my talk, I started out by saying, okay, traditionally speech recognition look at these human sound perception system and try to imitate that, but we sort of hit the bottleneck and we had to move away from that and go with the information theoretic approach where we actually don't try to imitate human model at all. And what's interesting with CNN is that a lot of times CNN or other deep neural net are being used as a black box. Mm-hmm. So we know it works. We don't
right.
know why.
Right.
And humans being humans are always interested in knowing why.
Right.
And in fact, there is a practical reason is that if you ever want to commercialize a technology like that
right.
to provide to your customers, they want to know why,
right.
what it's learning.
Right.
So we then took a look at the CNN, different layers of CNN, and saw that it was actually, as I mentioned in my talk, that it's basically approximating the filter bank in our cochlea
mm-hmm.
That's connected to the auditory system. And then we also saw that it's picking up on the amplitude, the peaks in the amplitude mm-hmm. that correspond to different emotions. So we thought that was very interesting that we could actually see what's going on. For example, it was always CNN was first applied to image recognition. And they use like 7, 8, 9 layers of CNN to achieve that purpose. And in image recognition, they were able to see that each layer, so for example, one layer is recognizing the edges of image and the other layer is recognizing maybe something else, some features on your face and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all very obvious and really nice. And we were never able to explain how deep neural networks on speech and language. So it was interesting to see why it works on emotion. We mm-hmm. still are not able to figure out what it's doing on languages. So what each layer is recognizing.
Mm-hmm.
We were hoping that each layer will correspond to some linguistic functions such as
right.
syntax or semantics. We haven't seen anything that neat yet.
Hmm.
So
interesting.
Yeah. So it's not blindly learning something. It's learning something which has a physical meaning.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. But you made the point that it's also an error to correlate it too tightly to brain function, because that doesn't really work.
It doesn't. It's not. Because, no, so even though I say it approximates human perception system, it's really the hearing system, right?
Right.
It's not the understanding part. It's
right.
The hearing system. And we know exactly how our hearing system functions.
Okay.
We know very, very well. We don't guess. But how our minds function in understanding the meaning, we don't know. We're activating our, I mentioned 100 billion neurons and 100 mm-hmm. trillion synapses to get that. Until we have neural network of that size, it's hard to come up with something similar to human cognitive ability.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, we don't have that. So that's why I say it's no coincidence that we can explain what CNN is doing for perception.
Mm-hmm.
So speech recognition and emotional recognition are both perception problems.
Mm-hmm.
Perception is actually easy because we understand human perception, how our skin feels, the temperature. We actually understand the physics of that very,
uh-huh.
very well. But once you go into understanding, which is language understanding, which
right.
is the trans, you know, if I want to use a noisy channel model, it would be from words to meaning.
Right.
Once we get into the realm of that, we're kind of clueless as to how humans, so there are a lot of linguistic theories about how humans think, how
yeah.
humans understand. But, you know, for every linguist theory, there are other people who will say no.
Right.
So there's there's no scientific truth that we all share right now about
mm-hmm.
how human mind understands language or understands anything else.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know a video of a cat is funny or not? How does our mind interpret humor? We actually don't know.
Right. A lot of marketers would like
right.
to be able to.
I know. So,
that, right?
yeah, how do you predict? For example, one thing we were asked, since we could classify music, we were asked by a company, say, hey, can you predict whether a song is going to be a hit or not?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we could predict that, wouldn't that be amazing?
Right.
No, you know, because, you know, even we look at big data of all the past hit songs.
Yeah.
It can't learn, it cannot predict what the next one, not yet. Maybe.
Right.
So all we can do right now is use engineering models to approximate input and output.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's really a mimicry. Like, just looking at this input, can we come up with output that's similar to the truth?
Mm-hmm.
So we're not in any way near to imitating human minds.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be, even the term deep learning is a new term for something that has been around for a while. So
mm-hmm.
it's a particular kind of machine learning.
Right.
It is no deeper, let's say, than other kind of machine learning methods. it's a terminology. And also, neural network, it's a very, very rudimentary kind of neural network. You know, for speech recognition, there might be tens of thousands of neurons.
Mm-hmm.
And for emotional recognition, much, much fewer.
Mm-hmm.
So that cannot compare to the human brain. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
One of the things that I noticed in your presentation is the when you're doing the emotion recognition, you're mapping it to kind of these names, common names we have for emotion, angry, sad,
yeah,
whatever.
Right, right.
Is that model even too simple, or is there an underlying more nuanced model for emotion? I'm sure there are.
Well, so there's a lot of research done on the underlying model for emotion, such as valence arousal,
mm-hmm.
you know, and there are models that try to predict that first before they predict the final label.
And to interrupt you, because I saw the slide, but these folks haven't. Valence arousal is, valence is like the strength of the emotion. And
no, arousal is the strength.
Okay.
Valence is the positive and negative of the emotion.
And so the various, you know, angry, sad, cool.
Yeah, it's a combination
of,
you're right. They are a combination of different values of valence and arousal. This is one emotion theory. So these are models that psychologists came up with.
Uh-huh.
To try to organize what we know about emotion. And so it's just human minds, we're symbolic animals. You know, we need to have names. We give names to everything.
Yeah.
So it's just easier for us to give a name to emotions so we know what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Rather than give this vague, you know, number.
Right.
Valence arousal. If I tell you, oh, this is valence arousal, this and this number,
right,
you wouldn't know what I'm talking about. If I say he's, you know, he's showing happiness on his face, you kind of know. So it's kind of emotion recognition is kind of like speech recognition when it was only recognizing isolated words.
Mm-hmm.
It's oversimplified for sure.
Yeah,
we're not good at all with emotion recognition. You saw my slides. The performance is nowhere near the ability, the performance of recognizing words. Recognizing emotion is much harder
right
now. One reason, as you pointed out, is that it's hard to define what emotion is, you know.
Yeah.
For example, maybe it's easy to see if somebody's happy, but is he smiling because he's happy, or is he smiling because he's trying to be polite?
Right.
And also, what about emotions like frustration? How can you tell? Sure, some things are obvious, you know, when someone's frustrated, if they're rolling their eyes or something. But there are other times, you know, from the voice, from the tone of your voice, we can tell a lot of things.
Right.
But we cannot tell everything all the time. So it is a long ways to go. You saw the accuracy. The accuracy these days, even the best commercial systems, is just like 60%, you know, at most 70%. And speech recognition, we're talking about above 90%.
Right.
So there's a long way to go for emotion recognition, and especially some more complex emotions like humor.
Sarcasm, I think.
Sarcasm, yes. Sarcasm and humor and deceit. You know, is this person lying?
Right.
And there are colleagues in the field who have come up with systems that has 70-some% accuracy in detecting deceit and actually performs better than humans. Turns out we're not very good at detecting deceit. We're not good at all.
Wow.
And humans are not very good in recognizing emotions.
Yeah.
You know what we found with when we did some human subject studies is that we found that women are better.
Uh-huh.
Women are more empathetic than men.
Uh-huh.
There was actually quantifiable. And then women can detect emotion across languages. In languages they don't know.
Interesting.
Also better than men in the same language. so you can talk about why the reason, you know, we're programmed to be mothers. We must recognize the emotion of a baby early on. And I think there's some merit to that. So although I'm not an anthropologist, I cannot prove that. But yeah, so...
Interesting.
And then the reasons, you know, you see there are a lot of women who are nurses. Doesn't mean men cannot be, but it just happened that way.
Right.
A lot of the caregivers are women, you know, kindergarten teachers, you know, just nannies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So if we want to build robots, we want them to be more like that,
More
empathetic.
You know? Right. Great. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down with me. It was a great discussion. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Would you like to share how folks can find your research, or are you on any of the social media networks?
Well, it's easy to Google my name,
okay,
which is Pascal Fung, Pascale. Fung is Fung. If you Google my name, you come to my website, which lists all our publications, our projects, and all that. And if they're interested, they can email me via that website as well.
Great.
Right.
Great. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. That's it for today's show. If you enjoyed this show or have something to add to the discussion, please leave a comment on the show notes page at twimlai.com/talk/9. Or tweet to me at Sam Charrington or at TwimmelAI to let me know what you think. Thanks so much for listening, and catch you next time.